and welcome to the show. I'm your host, Jason Knight, and on each episode of this podcast, I speak to some of the best and brightest product and product-related thought leaders and practitioners I can find to help inspire all of us to make great products, great product teams, and great product companies. This episode is sponsored by the New York Product Conference. Hundreds of passionate people will be heading to the Big Apple in April to learn from some of the best minds in product today, including my two-time podcast guest, April Dunford. If you want to be one of them, why not snag a special discount by heading to industryconference.com/New York and using code ONENIGHTINPRODUCT to get $50 off the entry price. Check the show notes for more details and do make sure to say hi to April for me. On tonight's episode, we speak all about transforming to the product operating model, what that even is, and why it was important to finally give it a name. We go deep on the mindset needed to get away from being a feature team product manager or product owner to being part of a truly empowered team, and the importance of evangelism and translating product principles into something your stakeholders actually care about, if you want them to care about it at all. For all this and much, much more, please join us on One Night in Product. So my returning guest tonight is Marty Kagan. Marty's a world-renowned thinker, commentator, coach, coach of coaches, consultant and author who's spent the past 21 years and 11 months exhorting people to create tech products that customers love and build extraordinary products with ordinary people and throwing in some tough love along the way. Marty's the author of two classic product management books, Inspired and Empowered, and could justifiably be named the godfather of product management. But just like the real godfather, just when he thought he was out, they pulled him back in and he's back with new book, Transformed, which he hopes to help companies move to the wonderful world of the product operating model. Hi, Marty. How are you tonight?
Thanks very much, Jason. I'm doing good. Hope you're doing well, too.
I am doing tip-top of the world, and I'm looking forward to transforming a few people tonight. But let's see how we get on with that. But I do have to ask, first things first, like when we spoke last time, which was about 3 years ago, it was just after Empowered came out, you said that writing a book was a big commitment, and you're obviously a very busy man. So I do have to ask, why on earth did you decide to write another book?
I know. It wasn't the plan, I can tell you that. The plan was that Empowered was going to be my last book, maybe another update in the edition of Inspired, and my partners were going to write the book. But the problem my partners had, and it went through three of my partners, is they all have young children. And the result was no writing. So after last year, basically, I said, well, okay, we do need this book. And I'm the only one whose kids are grown up, so I ended up doing it, you know, and it is a year of your life. So I didn't take it lightly, but you know, now I'm on the tail end of that, so I'm through it. But it's been a long year. I mean, that's a lot of work that goes into a book. But anyway, yeah, I did. I did one more. and it is supposed to be out in a couple days.
Yeah, well, actually, in the UK and I think in Europe as well, as you can see behind me, it seems to have come out a little bit early. So I don't know if there's been like some kind of Game of Thrones style leak or something like that where, you know, someone's accidentally pushed the wrong button at the wrong time. But I'm very glad to have had a chance to have looked at it before we got into this call. So thank you, whoever sent that out early. But that's an interesting point, though, because obviously you said that some of your partners at SVPG, that they kind of started. I guess they started at least, and maybe it was manuscripts, maybe it got a bit further than that. But kind of reminds me of like someone like J.R.R. Tolkien's son when he had to kind of pick up all of his dad's letters and try and turn them into additional books. How developed was the book before you got your hands on it? Like, did you have to basically rewrite it all, or was it basically just a curation job at that point?
Neither. There really wasn't much. So that was the bad side, is they hadn't got a chance to really get started even. And so, but the result was that I didn't have to redo anything. We could just create. And the way it worked really was each of the partners, I was able to get them to each contribute critical sections that I knew they were really experts on. So, yeah, that's how it worked.
Well, fair enough. Well, obviously, it all came together nicely and it's all just about to be out. I've obviously, as I say, pre-ordered it, got it early, read it, enjoyed it, and it's very relevant to some of the stuff that I do, very relevant to my interests. But just for those who haven't been as lucky as I have, or maybe haven't even come across the book yet, what's the core value proposition of the book? And for that matter, who should be reading it?
Well, Inspired is for product managers and product teams, and Empowered, as you know, is for product leaders. And what probably the single most common piece of feedback we have since the first version of Inspired, which came out in 2008, so it's a long time, and 2018 for the second edition, the most common piece of feedback is that, yes, they know they want to work like this. The problem is their company is so far away from working like that that many of them just don't even believe it's possible. They just literally don't believe it's possible. Or just frankly, it's like, where do we start? How do we get from here to there? They're not talking, you know, we're not talking minor changes. We're talking big changes. And in practice, that's what my partners and I have been doing for 20 years, is helping companies move to this model. But it's very different to help a relative handful of companies, right? Maybe 100 between us all. You know, there's only five of us. So not that many companies versus trying to write a book that describes that hopefully can be used by many. But that was the motivation of the book. Transformed was meant to not introduce new product techniques, but rather talk about the techniques to change to this model. That's the goal.
Yeah, I think I described it in my LinkedIn post the other day, at least a lot of the stuff around, you know, some of the principles, I guess, it's almost like they're very similar to what you'd expect from Inspired and from Empowered, because of course, that's your opinion. That's what you believe works. And that's what you go out and evangelize. So was it just a case, I mean, you've kind of basically answered this already, I guess, but just to clarify, it's primarily the case that you're taking the best of what you know and what you've learned and what you've pulled together over the years and making that consumable for a new audience? Or is this something that you'd also expect people, for example, maybe that are working in a slightly more well-run or better product company, that they'd still get something out of this book? Like, is there anything in it for them?
Yeah, well, the way we frame it is, in truth, Inspired and Empowered were written for product teams, right? Product organizations, product people like you and me. Transformed, in order to do its job, was the first book that we've done, which was intended for outside of the product org as well. So we needed something that a CEO, a CFO, a VP of sales, a head of marketing, these people could understand, because as you know, this kind of change impacts a lot more than engineers, designers, and product managers. And so getting the rest of the company to understand what they need to do to make it work, that was the main higher order bit, was to try to make it such that anybody in a company could understand what it meant and how they could help. And so it is describing a lot of the same core principles, because those are still the same principles. But they are just trying to describe them in a way that really makes sense to the whole company. That was the bigger challenge. And so the reviewers that we had came from CEO roles, CFO roles, not just, you know, all our favorite product people.
We all have our favorite product people. But I've long been suspicious that, for example, taking something like Inspired to one of those people, like, that's not going to win any arguments if they weren't already predisposed to try and read it anyway. And I guess the same could be said for Empowered. But I've generally been fairly concerned that taking someone a book, however good the book is and however targeted the book is, like, some leaders, I guess, just don't really like books, or they don't like these types of books. They like books that are written by the people that ran such and such a company, like Shoe Dog or something like that. Those are the books that they read. Do you think it's easy, or has it been easy, to get this in front of, aside from your reviewers, leaders that aren't product people?
Well, first of all, there's no question. There are some people that love books and some people that don't. One of the things you learn is that different form factors matter. So audiobooks, digital books, print books. But one of the things I learned even with Inspired was, it is remarkable how many CEOs, they don't care about blogs, they don't care about articles, they don't care about interviews like this. What they care about is a printed book from a big name publisher. That's sort of their version of curation. And so I have found that it's remarkable the number of CEOs that do want that. Of course, they have to be motivated. And the idea is, if you're motivated, and the main motivations are not big secrets, they're scared because of somebody like Amazon coming after their customers. They're excited about the potential valuation, like they see the valuations of these product model companies and they want their company to be valued like this, or their investors are pushing them to. There could be different reasons, but if that CEO is motivated, I mean, I've become a convert. When I started, by the way, writing, it was not with the intention of a book. I love blogs. I love, like, to me, that's perfect. These digestible little articles. People can go directly. You've got this amazing tool called Google. You can get right to the one you want. And, you know, it's super easy. But I also learned that a lot of executives, they view it really as a curation process. And so they focus in. A lot of them, they read reviews. They read like Bloomberg's best business books, that kind of thing. And you mentioned Shoe Dog. That was a great book. I love Shoe Dog. I love those origin stories in that case of Nike. And a lot of executives do. And I would say overall, as a target, you know, as a segment, senior leaders do read a disproportional number of business books.
Well, let's get it on their Christmas or Easter lists or something. But I think it's fair to say that, without wishing to blow smoke up anywhere, you're a very well-known, respected commentator. Some might even use the words thought leader, or I don't really like that phrase anymore, but definitely a big name in the world of product management. You put out a lot of your own content, as you just said. You've obviously written all the books. But in the book, you describe yourself not so much as a creator, but as a curator. Now, I think if there's anyone that we could sit there and say has created a lot of content, it would be you and obviously some of your partners as well. So are you just being a little bit humble? Or do you really see yourself as a curator of this product thinking?
Well, don't get me wrong. I would argue that there is a contribution there. However, we say this in every one of our books, which that none of the things we describe were invented by us. So that's just true. It wasn't invented by us. We didn't invent any of these things. There's a few concepts we've kind of been forced to name because there really wasn't a term for it. The most famous of one is product discovery. We were in the first edition of Inspired. I agonized because I didn't want to, you know, it's a marketing thing to introduce a new brand, you know, and it's very expensive and time consuming to introduce a new term like that. But I was like, I just literally don't know anything else. It's a wide open space. It needs a name. We also had to do that for Transformed. It was one of the most agonizing decisions was, because for years, if you look at all the other books and 20 years of blogs, you'll see we consciously avoided naming the destination. We used to just talk very vaguely and say, do you want to work like the best or do you want to work like the rest? That's about as imprecise as you could possibly be, right? You want to work like the best or the rest. That's what we would say. Because what's the name for the best? You could say, like, do you want to use the Amazon model? You want to use the Apple model? You want to use the Spotify model? I mean, but that, you know, that doesn't help because those, what we're all about is what's common between all of those companies, not what's unique about those companies. So we needed a term to represent how the good companies believed products need to be done. We converged on product operating model, or product model for short, mostly because we didn't like the other alternatives and we didn't want to invent another term. We didn't like product-led company. We didn't like product-driven company. You know, those have a lot of baggage associated with them.
Oh, yeah.
And we definitely don't like anything that implies a process or implies a framework or a recipe. And so an operating model is a conceptual model. We're like, okay, that's general enough. That could work. So, and we had seen it being used at some companies already that we worked with. So we're like, all right, we don't have to invent it, but we can adopt it. And that's what we did. So none of the books, you know, these techniques we talk about were not invented by us. None of them really. I do think what we do is, and I think it's hopefully others view it as a useful contribution, is when you get to know each of these companies enough, you can start to say what really is specific to Amazon and what is general that Amazon is just very good at. Because that's what I'm most interested in. Fundamentally, I'd like to, what we want to do is give people the best advice we possibly can to maximize their chances of success. That's all.
Yep, and I'll buy that, and we'll come back to the product operating model in just a sec and ignore the fact that it's got the word product op in it, because, you know, that starts to maybe could end up being something else that's been very controversial in the last year or so. But just back to this creator thing, I mean, I get what you say, and I agree. And it's obviously very true that most of the things that you do bring up, I mean, some of them have almost become, in some cases, almost cliches these days, because so many people are talking about them. And of course, you were one of the first to talk about them in the way that you do and in the books, but they've been kind of repeated so many times over the years by so many people that they almost become part of the background noise. And it does seem that there's a little bit of backlash brewing against quote unquote thought leaders these days, partly because it feels like everyone on LinkedIn and their dog is a LinkedIn influencer these days, partly because there are so many people out there that are kind of working in non-ideal situations and almost blaming these thought leaders for setting impossible standards. Like you just say, this is the North Star, but these people are like, well, we can't get there. So do you personally find it hard to keep flying the flag for these principles when there's some level of kind of uprising or backlash from the community? And there are so many other people doing it as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's a complicated one. First of all, I agree. My opinion is the vast majority of people that are considered thought leaders, it's ridiculous. Absolutely.
I'm right here, Marty. You don't have to pull your punches.
It's just, you know, it's funny. And stop me if I go too deep on this, because we could.
No, I want you to go deep.
I recently published a series of articles that were, even for me, a little spicy. they were called Product Management Theater, Product Leadership Theater, Transformation Theater. And it's calling out these ridiculous behaviors that people do. And I'll tell you what pushed me over the edge, because normally I try to, you know, I'm really pretty good about not responding to all the nonsense on social media. And, you know, as you know, it's like 90%+ is nonsense. Otherwise, you just go crazy. I think you go nuts.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty good about not. But anyway, there was this article making the rounds, and it was written by one of the, if not the biggest organization that certifies product managers. And I have air quotes for those that can't see me, because certification, I think, is completely BS.
Yep.
But anyway, they're the biggest name, and they're out there telling everybody this is a product manager. And I'm reading this article, and I can't believe that they're saying this out loud. Because usually people have a better sort of rationalization about why this is really important. But they were basically describing 100% project management role. And imagine, you know, to me, it's these are the people that are miserable in their jobs.
Oh, yeah.
Feature team product managers, or worse, product owners. And what are most of them doing? They're following 90% of the so-called thought leaders. So I was kind of calling bullshit on that and saying, this is just ridiculous. Now, what pushed me over the edge is because up until this year, basically, people were being just as ridiculous, but most of them weren't getting laid off.
Uh-huh.
Now people are getting laid off. And I've been warning people, and I admit it, maybe I was overly paranoid early on, but I've been warning people that this is not going to go on forever. The CEOs are not clueless. They are going to realize that these roles are ridiculous. And what these so-called thought leaders are saying is ridiculous. Now, that's one side of it. The other side is there's a whole set of people, and honestly, Jason, they've always been there, always, ever since, I mean, even when I first learned product, which was literally, you know, 4 decades ago, a long, long time ago, they've always been there. These are people that don't believe they have the power to change. This is really referred to as sense of agency. Do people believe that they can impact their own lives, their own job, their own team, their own company? And I was taught that you have way more ability to impact your life and your job. And I think product people in particular are selected for that trait. You know, in good companies, they select for that. They want people to you know, you can't do it. Nobody can do everything. Even a CEO can't do anything they want, right? But there is so much more you can do. So what I don't have a lot of sympathy for, and I know this is not very nice, but I don't have a lot of sympathy for those people to say, oh, it's impossible to work like a good company. I don't even think we should try. That's like, okay, you can be that way. I personally would never hire you. I don't want to work with you. I'm glad I didn't work with you. But, and honestly, I feel sorry for them. But, you know, it is a free world, right? I mean, if somebody wants to be happy as an order taker, that's fine. I just don't know many people that are happy like that.
Yeah, it's interesting because I personally, in the past, have certainly found myself at kind of my wit's end in certain companies. But then at the same time, I've always left those companies. Like, that's kind of the ultimate agency that you have, right? Like, you can do what you can, you can try the things, and if they don't work, you can go somewhere else. Obviously, that's a privileged position. Not everyone can do that, depending on their own circumstances. And I've certainly been privileged to be able to move on. And certainly now with the, you know, going out on my own, like, I've had the privilege to do that. So I want to acknowledge the fact that not everyone can just up sticks and leave. But it also...
But also, can I say, that's never my first choice either. I recommend to them not to leave. I recommend to them first, let me show you what you can do in your current spot, even as an individual contributor.
Yeah. And I think that's the thing, like giving people the tools to, well, and the motivation, I guess, to take the power back as much as they can. And again, to your point, having agency, I mean, that's definitely something that I try to do now, but I've definitely had my spots. And I want to acknowledge for anyone listening that sometimes you are just in a spot. But I've also seen some narrative recently from certain quarters of people almost giving up. And this isn't a new thing. Obviously, you've kind of touched on it already, but like putting blog posts up or Reddit articles up about basically, I'm fed up of trying to be a product manager. I'm fed up of trying to affect change. I'm just going to be the order taker, like you say, and just kind of get on with it because it's a paycheck and I can then just go and have a drink with my buddies after work and it's all going to be fine. Now, from what it sounds like, that's not what you would take, but do you have any sympathy for these people at all?
I mean, sympathy, a lot of sympathy, but not a lot of interest in helping them. If they don't want to be helped, nobody should force it on them. What I don't have a lot of tolerance for is there are people, you know, occasionally people will say, you know, it's not all bad to be on a feature team. You know, world needs feature teams too. And I always laugh at these rationalizations because, first of all, a product team can do everything a feature team could do and more. So why wouldn't you want to make yourself as useful to your team, as to your company, or to your customers as possible? I don't have a lot of sympathy for that. But I got an email just the other day that I thought was so funny. It was from an engineer that was complaining to me about all the changing in technology and how he hates it. And I'm like, oh man, did you pick the wrong career? Because, you know, product, if you chose a product manager job and you don't want to do these kinds of things, that's like, okay, something's wrong, right? Now, maybe you read a description of a product owner and you thought that's what you wanted to do. Okay, well, as long as it's there, I don't think it's going to be there that much longer, but as long as it's there, you might as well collect your paycheck. But if you are worried about your paycheck 12 months from now, you might want to look deeper at that.
But there are a lot of people out there as well these days also kind of calling out the end of product management. You know, AI is going to take it away, or the engineers can do it, or the UX team can do it, or the CEO can just do it themselves. And I mean, obviously, there's always a little bit of that, but it's been kind of brought into sharp relief by people like Airbnb or Brian Chesky coming out and doing all of the things that he did or didn't do or did or didn't say. And then you get all these other people maybe trying to copy the same method, even though they've never had any interest in how Airbnb worked before that one article. So do you feel that there's any risk, I guess, to the trade or the craft, not of product ownership, but of product management, of true product management in this world of AI and also the quote-unquote attacks from all of the other parts of all of our kind of cross-functional partners?
Well, they're not disconnected. Those, when you double-click on those attacks, whether it's Brian Chesky or whether it's these designers and engineers, what you'll find in virtually every case that I see is what they are is pushback against a feature team product manager, which, as you know, is a project manager. And many people are realizing this is crazy. Why are we paying this for a project manager? Why do we even have that? Because, you know, another thing the world has become a better, more recognizing of is that smaller is better in terms of teams. And so if you have somebody on a team that can't carry their own weight, they're in a vulnerable position. So I would argue, and I think generative AI is just sort of a magnifier on all this, because those people that have low value contributions, like I would argue literally a product owner role, or a lot of the project management, they're vulnerable. They're more vulnerable. And the irony is, in an AI-powered product and with AI-powered roles, the real product management, which I would not include feature team product management, I would only include what's talked about in these books, is not only the most, I mean, that becomes now the most important, because viability is like right there. And that is what's so hard about AI-powered products and services. And so those roles, I think, become more important. Just like real product designers become more important. The experiences are very difficult. And of course, in the engineering, the senior engineers are the ones leading this technology transformation. So their role is incredibly important as well. I think those are probably the most secure roles, but it is true that most of the rest are vulnerable to different degrees at different points in time.
Well, fingers crossed they'll pick up the book and work out ways to move in that direction. But I do think that point that you raised about the kind of dysfunctional companies, I guess, in a way that kind of breed these kinds of complaints, I think that's spot on, because I see so many criticisms of product managers, of designers, of developers, all criticizing each other. And then you also get people criticizing Agile or Scrum and all of these things. And anything's up for being criticized, right? But when you, to your point, if you kind of double click on any of those things, you soon find out that what they're describing is just the worst version of that thing that you've ever seen. And it's not even something that would ever be included in a definition of any of those things by the people who made those things. Like even something as ridiculous as Scrum. I mean, I'm no fan of Scrum particularly, but you get all these people banging on about it. And then you look at it and that is not what anyone who ever wrote anything about Scrum said to do. Stop complaining about that. Complain about your company.
Well, I wish what you just said was true. I genuinely wish.
Okay, not always, but often.
I'm just saying, a lot of the backlash against all the Agile process is a self-inflicted wound, because they're not actually doing the principles behind Scrum. They're just process people that are going crazy. Or, like I started this with, they are, in fact, advocating a ridiculous definition of the product manager job. In fact, the major organizations that certify these people are doing that. So is it a fringe? I don't think so. So, Jason, imagine that you're a brand new product manager. You just got hired by some company and you are trying to figure out your job. And unfortunately, your manager doesn't know any more than you do. And so you're kind of on your own. Okay, well, lots of us have been in that situation. So you go online. And if 90% of the content out there is written by people who come from feature teams, if 90% of the speakers at conferences, you pick the percentage, 80%, 90%. If you go and post a question to any of the forums anywhere, and if 90% of the people that are answering questions, if they all come from that model, what's the chance that you're actually going to learn how to be a good product manager? And how would you know as a new person, who to trust, who to believe? It's really tough. And I want to be clear. I know there are more good people out there in product than ever before. But there's also more nonsense than ever before, right? The beauty of the internet. So this is the reality in so many companies, because one of the things that has really perplexed me over the years is, after so long, why is there still so many people that are spouting nonsense?
Well, it's probably due to some kind of LinkedIn algorithmic bias or something that promotes that stuff up to the top. I don't know. But at the same time, that gives people like us a chance to shine as well, right? But some people might sit there in all seriousness and say, well, that sounds great, Marty, but who died and made you king?
Well, I maybe not in so many words, but I've definitely heard it. But I'd be the first one to say it, that you should decide for yourself. It really is a buyer beware. You should decide. You should do some real work and decide, you know, if somebody says something, don't just take it at face value, me or anyone else. Use your brain. Try to figure out, like, well, where did they learn product? And that's the first thing I always look at. Where did they learn product? Who did they learn product from? Might even be somebody, you know, awesome. But if they haven't actually practiced it and they know what good looks like, the chances of them being able to help others is considerably lower. In fact, I did something kind of unusual. I hope you noticed it in the new book, Transformed, which is, because this is right at the heart. Let's say you're a company that does believe you need to transform. And let's say you do decide that I might actually have something useful to say. And so you're reading this book. And then you realize, okay, our problem now is we do know we need to change. But as a leader, I've never worked this way. So either I can replace myself with somebody who does know, or I can get some help. And most people are going to want to get some help. The problem is, how do you know who to hire to help you, even as a coach, even for a few months? And I kept running into this problem. Now, if they're people I know and they do happen to trust me, then we recommend somebody that we know that we trust. And that's kind of how they go. But I wanted to try to help people who are reading the book to learn enough about what to look for, that they can judge the candidates out there, because there's a lot of people that call themselves product coaches today, more good ones than ever before, but more of everything than ever before. So I want them to be able to interview these people and know what to look for. So I profiled 7 actual product coaches in the book.
Yeah.
It talks about what their journey was, where they learned the craft of product, and then how they, you know, what's their view on coaching, so that hopefully people that read that, you know, reading 7, it's like, okay, I see the pattern. I'm going to have to look for somebody like this. And I'm hoping that's what helps them get pointed in the right direction.
Well, hopefully it's a good start, and obviously know some of those people and was glad to see them called out. People like Gabby's been on the podcast before. Hope's supposed to come on one day, so I'll make sure she does after she hears this so that we can get some of that residual love for her. But I want to talk now about 3 aspects of transforming to a product operating model, which you kind of call out in the book, and just kind of riff a little bit on some of the factors that will maybe lead to success or failure. So one of those factors is, and you've kind of touched on it yourself, this idea of the leader needing to buy into this stuff. And you do say in the book, to paraphrase, that if the CEO is not on board, then none of this is going to work. So is that like 100% given, or is there some kind of bottoms up transformation that we can do and eventually persuade these people to do it? Like when I interviewed you before, you talked about founders finding religion. Is it still that fundamental that if they don't fully believe up front, then it's never going to work?
No, and I hope, you know, when people read it, the nuance comes across. It is a lot harder if the CEO or the general manager of a very big company, you know, because in a big company, there's a bunch of business units. And so the equivalent of a CEO in a business unit is a GM. And so they're the ones. The reason, of course, is the most important thing. There's a lot that could be done by the product leaders and the product teams, but to really get the power of the product model, it goes beyond product. It goes to marketing, sales, finance, HR, the other stakeholders. And so that's where the role of the CEO comes in. Now, it's also true that you can earn this trust bottom up. And we talk a lot about that. You can earn it. Even for an individual contributor can earn the right for their team to work different ways. And then certainly a product leader. I have more sympathy when you're a product, an individual contributor, and you're like, oh, my company doesn't understand any of this. It's hard. There are definitely things you can do, but there's a cap there on what you'll be able to impact. On the other hand, for product leaders, when they complain, it's like, oh my gosh, you should not be the product leader. You need to realize just how much you can impact. And one of the things when I coach those product leaders one-on-one is I point out to them, you have the ability to earn the trust of the other leaders in the company. You have the obligation to win over their hearts and minds. That is your job as the product leader. So if you're willing to put in the work, you can be amazed at the impact you can have across the organization, even to the point of getting that engagement with the CEO or the general manager and explaining, you know, with your help, we could do even more.
So that kind of touched on point two, which was about complaining product leaders, which you also call out in the book, the idea that they do pretty much what you just said, and the product leaders themselves give up and they, you know, basically stymie any chance of success. And you've basically just covered all that bit. So I guess we can move on to the third type, which I'm actually going to kind of expand upon my what I originally wrote down, which was you talk in the book about, for example, product managers that were never product managers, and you kind of touched on it earlier with the product owners and, you know, all these other project managers or glorified project managers that you have in an organization. But I actually wanted to talk a bit more about product leaders with the wrong job titles. And I've got a very specific thing in mind here, because something I see a lot out there, out and about, and with people I speak to, or when I'm coaching people, mentoring people, whatever, you hear a lot about people who are working for product leaders that are product leaders in name, but they've never actually worked themselves in a product organization as such. They've never worked as a product manager. They've never worked as a product leader in a product sense. And some people will be like, well, you know, they're still great business people, and that's fantastic. They've got the strategy, but they've got that lack of connection to the product organization because they've never worked in it. Do you think it's possible for a person like that to drive substantive change within an organization if they've never actually worked or been in the trade themselves?
I do. Let's talk about two scenarios here. They could be, both could fit into your hypothetical here. In the first scenario, they're a very well-respected stakeholder. And if, let's say, you know, if they are well-respected stakeholders, a good chance the CEO really trusts that person. That person, if they have an open mind and can learn quickly, and they probably can, or they wouldn't have that respect, they can actually do amazing things. A lot of the best product leaders in the world came through that path. We can talk, Amazon does this really well. Apple does this really well. They could come through engineering, they could come through design or product, but they can come from anywhere. But they can learn these other skills. There's some real value to that. The other scenario is that you're a product manager in a product organization, but you've only ever been a feature team product manager, which means, right, you're good at project management. That's what you're good at. And now, though, since you're the best in the organization, you've been promoted to a director or a VP. And so now you are officially a product leader, but all you really know how to do is be a manager of project management at best. And so those people are in the spot, but they don't really realize they have a very different job. So that's back to, in both cases, it's back, as long as the person is humble enough to realize that I need help to learn this stuff, that's where a product leadership coach can make a real difference.
Oh, well, if only we knew seven or more of those that we could recommend. But in the book, you also talk about some of the perils of transformation theater. And you kind of touched on that earlier on as well, this idea that sometimes it's all just for show. So what are some of the signs of that transformation theater, either as you're coming in or maybe if you're coming in as a coach and you're trying to help out and you start to realize that all is not what it seems? Are there kind of common warning signs where you'd walk into a company that's superficially transforming, but actually when you get there, they're going either in the wrong direction or they've just stalled?
You know, what we see is they've spent years, quote, transforming and spent all this money, but at the end, they really don't have much to show for it. What we realize has gone on is transformation theater. And that comes in many forms. I mean, probably the most prevalent form is agile theater. There is real value to agile. It's amazing, though, how you have to work so hard to find it, because so many people are all about that theater, the whole move to safe, all these crazy product coaches, agile coaches everywhere. You know, it's theater. It's process. It's not product. And so that's a common form of theater. Another one is that they, it's kind of related, you know, whenever you get these, what happened really? They retitled a bunch of business analysts or some other job to product owner or maybe product manager, but they didn't actually redefine the real job and go through what you really need to do, which is every person do an assessment, decide how much work they have to do to change, and then if they're even willing to do those changes. That's the hard work of really transforming. But Most people don't want to do that. Most HR departments don't want to do that. Most CEOs don't want to do that. And especially they'll often say, oh, we only hire good people. And I'm like, look, you're on a path to failure. It's just so common. Unless you're willing to invest in these four, there's four critical competencies that are new competencies. Even though you may have those titles, they are new competencies. Unless you're there, you know, product always comes down to the people. And if you don't have the people in the right skills, right role, you're going to have trouble. And so that's critical.
So come on then, what are the four competencies for the record?
Yeah, well, like I said, many companies have these titles, but they're usually defined very differently. The first one is product manager, not to be confused with a feature team product manager or a delivery team product owner. Right? If your training in product was done by a CSPO or a PSPO class by an agile coach, you got nothing to work with there. You need to really start fresh. Second, real product designer. And I'm not just talking graphic design. I'm talking service design, interaction design, visual design, but especially that interaction and service design skills. The third competency is a tech lead, engineering tech lead. This is a senior engineer that cares as much about what's built as how it's built. Those people are worth their weight in gold. And then the fourth competency is the one you brought up earlier, which is real product leaders. Real product leaders that understand the job that they need to do.
Absolutely, and something that we all aspire to develop more of. But part of the problem with transformations in general, when you call it out in the book, and it's been called out in other books as well, which all kind of riff on this idea that a big part of the problem is you have existing stakeholders that are used to working in a certain way. You talked about HR, for example, and the CFO and the CEO. They've probably not asked all of them to be transformed. It's somewhat against their will in the first place. They may not even really be aware of what being transformed or transforming the company means. And they're either unhappy or frightened or both of the kind of loss of power and prestige that they might have in this new organization. Now all these product managers and product leaders and product designers and tech leads are coming in to steal their lunch. So how can we bridge those gaps and make sure that the transformation is both accepted and, I guess, welcomed by the whole organization rather than just the people that are going to be at its heart?
Well, of course, one approach to that is sort of what the agile transformation people did, which is say, you don't even have to be bothered. We're not going to bother you. We're just going to mess with the engineers. And of course, all that is really transforming is delivery. It's not transforming product. And so one of the things we say is, unfortunately, that is not tackling the big issues. We need to do more than that. So this is why we don't like the terms product-driven or product-led, because if the stakeholders perceive this as power going from them to you, who's going to be happy about that? I mean, just common sense, right? But and the other thing is, even if that were the case, it doesn't work very well, because product is all about coming up with a solution that's fantastic for your customers, but also works for the business. So what we really want to do is move from the model where the stakeholders are driving things to a model where the stakeholders are truly collaborating with the product organization to come up with solutions that work for both.
Absolutely. And I guess a second point to that, though, is it's not just the stakeholders that get that fear. We kind of touched on it. The leaders themselves can get the fear. The CEO can have the fear. And one thing that I have seen, and I'm sure you've seen as well, is that even if they supported or sponsored the transformation in the first place, first speed bump or the first hard decision that goes against their better instincts, they kind of lose faith in the whole idea and lose heart. And they decide, well, this is a bit too much effort. Let's just go back to how we were, or kind of half-ass it and just, you know, do some kind of middle ground that doesn't quite work. Are there any techniques that you've seen or used or curated yourself to make sure that leadership are more likely to try and stay the course?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, now you're really getting to the core of what really makes transformation hard. Because first of all, unless they're motivated, I warn them, you know, the CEO really needs to know what he or she is getting into, because this is a journey. And most of them are instantly, they love the idea of moving from output to outcomes, because that's not very hard for a business leader to understand the virtue of. What they don't understand necessarily is how in the world do you do that? Really? Well, what does that even look like? Yeah, it sounds great, but so does all kinds of fantasy things, right? So they want to know, how does that really work? And that's why when you come to the people element of this and the time element, because it could take years to transform a big organization. Even though it can take 2 to 3 years, you want value to start appearing in weeks. And so what we have is a number of techniques to make that happen. You need to show early wins. You need to show continuous wins. You need to highlight those wins. So now we're getting into what's referred to as transformation evangelism. So you have to keep the interest, the excitement, the faith for this period. And the main way we do that is we start showing real results continuously. So you try to do that for a whole company at once, it doesn't work. You start with pilot teams, you start showing the value there. There's usually an inflection point that happens in a transformation where the leaders see something that they've been able to do that they could never do before. And that's kind of when you could see the switch flip in their minds. And they realize, in the book, we documented several transformations and we tried to highlight when that actually happened. Like, this is what happened. A lot of times for the CEO, it's they realized that their people were capable of things that they never knew they were capable of. They never knew they could provide these kinds of solutions to customers where even their customers didn't even know it was possible. The executives didn't even know it was possible. And they start realizing that's what this is all about. So we're looking for wins like that. There's what are we really talking about? Politics, people. You need to keep the drum beating.
And that's the job of the product leader in this equation, would you say?
Yes, the product leader, they are the ones that are really responsible for this. First of all, because most of the people that have to change work for them. And if they don't raise the game of the people on the teams, it's sort of game over before it even starts. Right. And then even if they do that, then they have to win over the hearts and minds of the stakeholders. And that happens when you show them what these teams can do.
Yeah. And I think that idea of kind of quick and continuous wins and, you know, showing value and showing your work, these all, you know, really resonate. And I know how tough it can be to almost swim against the tide in some cases. But again, as long as you can show them something, and something that I've often try to work out, a ways to show them in ways that they inherently or intrinsically care about as well. So not just sitting there, you know, with no offense, like waving your book at them and saying, hey, look, it said that that's a good idea in here, but trying to connect that to something that they actually care about because they cared about it before, and showing them how what you're doing actually impacts the thing that they already cared about, because that starts to then bridge the two worlds.
Yeah. In fact, what you're describing is very real. A lot of teams, because look, moving to outcomes is hard. Does anybody who's ever done that, work that way, knows how hard it is? And a lot of people will literally, pretty much every couple of weeks, I'll get an email from somebody saying, you know, we're looking for KPIs to show our progress. What do you think of the number of experiments every week in discovery? Or they have some other like highlight of a technique that's in my book or say Teresa Torres's book or something. And I'm like, look, I think you should do those techniques. I'm sure Teresa would say the same thing, but that's not a business result. They are only useful techniques if they help you achieve the result. So what you talk about with executives is not books, is not techniques, is not methods. That's sausage making to most of the company. What they care about is show us the results, show us the money. And that is, that's what product is really about, to show those results. Most people don't care. And I would be the first to say that.
All right. So the last time we spoke, I asked you about trends in product management and what you were monitoring. And you called out product operations at the time. You were pretty suspicious. You were trying to work it all out. And obviously that all blew up afterwards. And there was lots of controversy going around back and forth. And then there was some additional posts from yourself. You mentioned it in passing in the book as well. And you said earlier about this whole idea around, like, you don't want too much process. You don't want to sponsor process. You don't want process to get in the way. So I think you've kind of put a full stop or a period after that, which is good. But what's on your mind these days? Like, what are you seeing out there as you kind of go out there and speak to product teams, product leaders, interacting with the community, like a new trend that's on your radar right now that you're suspicious about?
Well, it's funny. You spend more time on social media than I do. I don't even really know about the controversies you're referring to. but I do try hard to stay away from them. So that's probably why. I don't know. But it was a mess early on with product ops because so many, I just kept asking people that were referencing it how they were defining it. And I kept getting different answers. So I don't call that a controversy. I just call that a mess. That's all. And I was trying to, trying to understand what the different arguments were around product ops. And then, of course, book came out, which I think helped stabilize a little bit. If you read the book, they basically talked about two main pillars of product ops, which is user research and data analysts, which, I would point out have existed in companies for 20 plus years. So this is not a new thing, but putting them under a single manager of product ops is a new thing. And I don't think that's a bad thing either. The third pillar is where it could go either way, because the way in that book they defined it, which I consider very unfortunate, is what was it? Process and governance. Two evil words, as far as I'm concerned. is it necessarily the worst thing in the world? No, but it's not a good sign. And so I just tell people, just focus on the first two. Those two are very valuable. Just focus there. You're fine. There is another trend, though, that's going on that honestly is probably the biggest reason I think product ops hasn't really, as far as I can tell, it hasn't really gone anywhere. And that is there is a lot less willingness by companies to staff all these supplementary roles, partly because of cost of funds. Partly because of overhiring during the pandemic, partly because of generative AI, partly because bigger teams are not as good as smaller teams. Even when you can make a good, solid argument for every additional role, there is a less visible hidden cost there. And so, when you split up the product role, because most good teams, even today, they don't have assistants. Product managers don't have assistants. Designers don't have assistants. Engineers don't have assistants. But there are, if we all had a blank check, there's a lot of these other possible roles. So I don't see it doing too much. I see it still, a small user research team, a small data analyst team is helping all product teams. By whatever name organization, I think that's very useful. There's a strong ROI for that. But it's easy to get carried away.
And all of a sudden, you've got 250 product ops managers all floating around. And I think one of the things that you did put in the book, and it was certainly one of my initial questions as well, and something that certain people have disabused me of the idea of, but like that there are certain organizations out there where it's just like the revenge of the PMO that's kind of just coming back and taking over all of the operational stuff again because they got kicked out when all of these empowered product managers came in and they kind of needed to find a way back. Now, again, as you say, there are certainly ways that it works that isn't like that, and definitely we all should be more in favor of that. But yeah, I'm no fan of over-processing, and I very much think of the idea of, I think it was in the Netflix book, No Rules Rules, where it's like, if you want to optimize for innovation, you need as little process as possible. If you want to optimize for repeatability, then you need lots and lots of process. I don't want someone innovating as they're landing a plane. I want them to follow that checklist to the letter. But if I want them to invent me a new plane with certain safeguards, I want them to think outside the box a little bit. Although I guess the Boeing people did that and that didn't work out too well. So maybe they should have...
No, the Boeing people did the... Boeing people outsourced it. That's the worst.
Well, yeah, you're not a fan of outsourced engineering teams, for example, and I guess that's something that some bigger companies might find a controversial take, right? Because a lot of these companies are going to have outsourced a lot of their stuff, either to a their own permanent people, but just in another country, or actually to like a dev shop somewhere. So do you think that any of this stuff could work with an outsourced team, or do you think that's generally a kind of an anti-pattern that's going to stymie their progress?
Well, I think it's more than an anti-pattern, really. It is pretty severe. And I tell them, not a single one of the product companies that are good at this stuff, not only would do they not do this like that, but they wouldn't do this. And I said, it's really important for you to understand why. And by the way, I point out to them that every company I've ever seen that has successfully transformed, it doesn't take more money, it saves money. So outsourcing sounds like it's a cost saver. It's not a cost saver. So it's not about the people being in India or wherever. The issue is that they are not dedicated, durable members of the product teams. That's the issue. And they need, what's really going on is they don't understand the real role of engineering. Because if they did, they wouldn't even consider outsourcing. So that's part of our job, to educate them about that. And that includes educating the CFO or the true costs of the decisions that they've taken.
No, absolutely. If you can't boil it down to a number that the CFO likes, it's always difficult to win that battle as well. Kind of goes back to trying to connect things to the things that they already care about, right? So definitely get that. Right, final question. I like to get actionable in this podcast these days and not just all fluffy, wavy, handy. So I want to think, or I want to imagine, I want you to imagine, a struggling product leader, one of these that we talked about earlier that's maybe not getting on too well with their transformation efforts, or they're struggling to get buy-in, or struggling to be that evangelist, and they're kind of losing all hope, and maybe they're even going to write a post on Reddit in a minute to say how they're going to give up on all of this stuff and they just want to be a feature factory person now because that's easier for them and they can cash their check. What is one thing, one step that you would advise that person to take to kind of get them out of that funk and start to make a big impact in their company?
Oh, good. Let's even though you framed it around just the product leader, let's also talk about that same exact question, but for an individual contributor, because I get that one probably the most of all. And I bet a lot of your listeners are in that boat. They're a product manager. They're feeling vulnerable for all the reasons we've talked about. They're feeling vulnerable. So my argument to them is the minimum you should do. You can do this, and it will, I promise, at a minimum, it will help you, probably get you promoted. But if, you know, at the least, you would be further down the list of targets for layoffs or something. So we want you to be as best chance as possible. And so what would that be? It means up-leveling your skills. Literally doing a self-assessment, or hopefully getting somebody who knows what good looks like and help you with that assessment. And then giving yourself a few months to raise your game. Just going from a product owner to a real product manager in your skills, I promise you the rest of your team will be grateful. I also promise you there will be other people in your company, hopefully some leaders, that will recognize that you now have skills that are truly valuable and are way more than a backlog administrator. So raise, you know, do that. There's no reason you can't do that. It will at least help you in your current job, and it would certainly help you moving to other jobs. That's what's in the cards for you. Similar to that, for a product leader, I would go further though, because the expectations on a product leader are a lot higher, obviously. I would, first of all, you need to educate yourself about what your job really is. I mean, that was the motivation for writing the book Empowered, was for product leaders that would tell me they're in the job, but they've never done it before. They don't know what good looks like. That was the purpose of that book. So at the very least, read the book, see what you don't know. The next thing I'd recommend is, get a product leadership coach. And, you know, we recommend them almost every day. It is important for people to understand we don't have any financial ties with any of the coaches. We don't want them. We just want to know a set of good people that if we recommend, we know they'll give them good advice. That's all. So, email us. We're happy to, you tell us where you're based. We'll try to recommend somebody that we think is good. So that you can dramatically raise your game, raise your abilities, and then you can start demonstrating to your company what you're capable of. And there's a very good chance when the company sees that, they'll start saying, okay, what else can you do?
Well, there you go. Some inspirational and empowering words there that could transform someone's career. But I do feel silly for asking, but, you know, just for the record, where can people find you after this? You just talked about, for example, emailing you. If they want to find out more about any of the books, get a recommendation for a coach, keep up to date with your writing in general, or receive a little bit of that tough love that you started to dispense these days.
Sure. Just go to svpg.com. It stands for Silicon Valley Product Group.com. And you'll see all this stuff and everything's free on the site, and help yourself.
Well, there you go. Well, hopefully a few people will come over and maybe even follow you on LinkedIn, even though you don't use that sort of thing apparently anymore. I noticed you left Twitter as well, which is, you know, a moral choice that I'm definitely behind, although I've started to feel myself seeping back a little bit, but I need to kind of...
I am not on Twitter anymore, but I am on LinkedIn. I just, for my own mental health reasons, minimize my exposure to once a day. And that's where I do posts, like I announce new articles and stuff on LinkedIn. And overall, I think LinkedIn is a much healthier environment.
Absolutely, although it had crashed and stopped working earlier. So I'm wondering what all of those quote-unquote thought leaders will be doing with their time until it comes back. But hopefully they'll be writing some really good listicles that we can share around later on. Well, I will make sure to link all of that stuff into the show notes, as well as obviously links to all the books. And hopefully you'll get a few people transforming in your general direction. Well, that's been a fantastic chat once again. Obviously, super grateful as ever that you can find the time to speak to me about all of this stuff. Here's wishing you best of luck with the book. Obviously, we'll keep in touch. But yeah, as for now, thanks for taking the time.
Oh, thanks for inviting me, Jason. Enjoyed it again. Take care.
As always, thanks for listening. I hope you found the episode inspiring and insightful. If you did, again, I can only encourage you to pop over to onenightinproduct.com. Check out some of my other fantastic guests, sign up to the mailing list, or subscribe on your favourite podcast app, and make sure you share with your friends so you and they can never miss another episode again. I'll be back soon with another inspiring guest, but as for now, thanks and good night.